Testing. Testing. Testing.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, good morning, sir. The market of Nigeria allocated current business. 80% of the
Good morning, Mr. Emmanuel. How are you?
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Sorry, my mic was muted.
Okay, I thought maybe it was mine. I was kind of checking it. Okay.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So how is campus?
It's fine. Nothing new.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
But I mean, assuming we needed to sort of have an exam with several people on campus, what's the possibility?
Yes. I'm not sure about if the management will agree to that, but it's possible because we have some people who are here. For instance, Efyong and Umar and this Mary and also Margaret, they're all here. It's possible for them to come to the campus, but the problem is these managerial issues. But if Dr. Prasad could convince them, I think it can be done.
Okay. So what's happening? Are you all using the same device in one classroom, or you're still using your separate devices?
We are using separate devices.
Okay. So it wasn't possible to like get a lecture room, or I think they used to have a video conferencing room. Yeah,
it's present, and I think these guys are material science people. They are using that conference room for their lecture right now.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah, because there are some lecturers who are here, so they conduct lectures from there.
Okay.
But it's possible even to use the computer lab.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Fiong. Are you all in the computer lab?
No. Hey, I'm in my house.
Okay. You're in your house.
Yes, sir. All the way far from us, from Abuja.
Okay. And where is that?
It's in Sabah, Delta State.
Okay, Delta State. No? Well, oh, maybe I'm wrong. No, I didn't hear properly.
Good
morning, Margaret. How are you?
Fine, thank you, sir.
Okay. I understand you're on campus today.
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. But you're in Abuja.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So Miss Efyong, I believe, is the one who's connecting from a cell phone. Yeah.
Yes, I should go on.
Okay. Yeah, so how many of us do not have access to a laptop?
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Miss Ogbe. How are you?
I believe, fine, thank you. I believe F. Young does not have, and Atu has complained of a system being called.
As Miss F. Young doesn't have, and Hannah too has complained.
Yes, and Atu.
That her own is slow.
She says she can't multitask on it, that she can't do two things at a time.
Okay, I understand. Okay. Morning, Victor.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine today, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone this morning. Before we start, are there any questions from the previous lessons you would like us to address or discuss this morning? In principle, you can also write your questions on the chat. There were some suggestions by people that they were not able to access the videos of the previous lectures. I hope everybody has been able to access it and there were no problems with viewing. Okay, nobody is saying anything, neither is anybody chatting. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll assume everyone has been able to access them.
I was able to access them.
Okay. And you don't have questions from the previous classes we have done this week or last week or any time before?
None for now, although I'm still going through yesterday's one. I was not able to attend yesterday's lecture.
Okay. So in the absence of questions, I'm going to move on to something new for today.
Sir, I have a question, sir.
Okay, what's your question?
But not from yesterday's lectures. I just want to know the general difference between these POSIX and OpenMP. Like, what's the main difference
between the POSIX thread and OpenMP?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. Like, what's the main difference? How do I explain it to someone if I'm being asked? Like, what's the main difference?
OpenMP is generally, it's more flexible and it's easier to work with. You realize that with OpenMP, all you had to do was put directives in your code and then change a flag for the compiler and you are more or less up and away. With pthreads, you need to add in functions for threading into your code. So there are special calls, there are special APIs you have to sort of know about before you can use them. So OpenMP is way easier to use than pthreads. And then OpenMP exists for more languages. It exists for, you can do it in Fortran, you can do it in C or C++. Whereas POSIX thread, I believe, only exists on the C platform. Apart from that, they both give you functionally similar behavior. Okay, so that's
okay, sir. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay. Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay. So let me start today's presentation. Okay, today we're going to cover the last of the major topics I've planned. We'll be looking at matrices, predictions, and measurements, especially for high performance. I think according to the curriculum or according to the schedule, we're supposed to have looked at this in the first week. But it's still a good time, I think. Now that we've been able to do some programming, we've been able to do things in parallel, and we've also gotten our hands dirty on several clusters, it's time to look at the more abstract world of how you can measure their performances, how you can predict performances, and what matrices are available for doing this. Basically, the presentation this morning is structured into two parts, hardware and software. It's quite a short presentation, and we will hopefully be done with it, and then we start talking about the exams. But the first part will cover hardware, how you measure, what matrices are available for measuring performance of hardware, what predictions can be made with respect to hardware, and what measurements are made typically on hardware. The first metrics we're going to consider is known as the FLOP, F-L-O-P, or FLOPS, F-L-O-P-S. It's just an acronym for floating point operations per second. Okay. And it's derived from a very easy principle. So the principle is, if I look at how many distinct processing units I have in a computing device, and I can multiply the number of floating point operations that each of these processing units can perform in a cycle with the clock speed and with the number, the simple multiplication gives us a measure of how well that computing device can perform with respect to computations. So it's three basic objects that are multiplied together: clock speed, number of processing units, and the number of floating point instructions that each processing unit can perform in a cycle. Practically, we have to translate this into things we know about a CPU. So if you've been with us from the first week, we should realize by now that our processors tend to have cores, they have threads, and they also have a clock speed. So in calculating the FLOPS for a CPU, we simply take the clock speed, we multiply by the number of cores, we multiply by the number of threads per core, because typically that's a measure of how many physical units you have inside each core. And then you multiply by the instructions, floating point instructions that can be computed in one cycle. And the result of that simple calculation can give you the FLOPS for a CPU. The same concept has also been applied to accelerators. So especially for the GPU kind of accelerators, we are talking about slightly different things, but the meaning is basically going back to the basic definition we have above. So clock speed once again, and then number of distinct texture mapping units. GPUs were made to draw things on the screen, so they have texture mapping units, what we probably also call cores, okay? And then the number of raster operations that can be performed per cycle. Okay, and so if you carry out that multiplication, you should get the flops of a GPU device. If I now want to extend this to calculate the flops for a computer, a whole computer, I have to multiply by the number of CPUs. Sometimes people will say number of sockets, okay, but it's nothing more than the number of physical CPUs that exist in the system. So I simply calculate the flops for a single processor and multiply by the number of processors I have in that system, and that gives me the flops for that computer. If the computer also has a GPU device, then I can also equivalently also calculate the GPU flops and multiply that by the number of GPU cards you have in the system. And I sum this together to arrive at the flops for the computer. What if I wanted to do it for a bunch of computers, such as we have in a cluster, a HPC cluster, or even a supercomputer? It's nothing more than just adding the sum of the individual devices we have in the system. And that should give us a metric or a value that is easy to compare. Are there any questions about this? Has anyone heard about flops before?
I have a question.
Okay, go for it.
All these parameters stated out as core, stretch core, instruction per second speed, do they have units that if we are given a word problem, we can be able to distinguish, okay, this is for the core, this is the parameter for the core, this parameter for the thread, like do they have units attached to them?
They have units, okay. So the units for speed, of course, you know it's hertz, right? So you can have speed being measured in megahertz, gigahertz, and things like that. So those are the common, most of the processors nowadays operate in the gigahertz region. The number of cores is just a number, so it doesn't have any units, let's say. Number of threads is just another number, but it doesn't have any units. Okay. And instructions per cycle is also measured a number per hertz. So you'll find that the hertz from speed cancels out the hertz from instructions per cycle. And what you are left with is just a unitless entity. So flops are numbers, but they don't have any entity in that respect. Do you get it?
Okay. Yes, sir. I have another question.
Okay.
When under the GPU flops, this texture mapping, right? That texture mapping. On that speed times texture mapping unit. Like, how exactly you said, because when you were explaining, you said that like cores, like, are they similar to cores or?
Okay. So, in the classical GPU hardware, as the device that drives the screen on your laptop, okay? You tend to speak about texture mapping units. So essentially, your graphics card has specialized sections within it for drawing things on your screen. So the question is, how many of these distinct units does your graphics card have? Okay. When we talk about GPUs, as in the ones that are used for computations, they tend to provide cores. But they are more or less telling us about the same thing. Okay. So in a sense, why is it called texture mapping units? For example, let's say in the very early days of graphics, trying to build the videos for computer screens and the very early computers. You may have had a monochromatic display, that's a display that provides only one color, let's say green. And then when you try to draw an image, you will find that there's a cursor moving from the left to the right on the first line, then left to the right on the second line, left to the right on the third line, and so on and so forth. So it was a very laborious operation to produce a picture on a screen. So if I was showing the PowerPoint slide on such a computer, whenever I change a slide, we'll have to wait a few seconds for it to finish building the whole image on the entire screen. But by having more processing units, they were able to say, okay, one processing unit can build the first line, a second processing unit can build the second line, a third processing unit, third line, all the way down. And then the convention was to have about 66 lines, if I'm not mistaken. So what this means is that if I have 66 texture mapping units or processing units in a GPU, the time to build an entire page is just a matter of all 66 of them picking a line and drawing a line from left to right, and then the image is done, okay? And as we moved into the era of colors, we also discovered that colors can be held with 8 bits or even 16 bits or even 32 bits. So for true color, you are talking about 16 bits and above. So the color that is shown on each part of the screen. And so at the end of the day, it's reached a situation where we are having more or less a processing unit per byte of what is shown on the screen. Okay, a byte for what is shown on the screen. And at that point in time, building a picture on the screen is shown as a complete picture. So once I say display a picture, when I change a slide, it's changed almost immediately. And your computer draws it almost immediately because it has several, maybe hundreds of processing units or texture mapping units, all responding at the same time, and they all flip the image to the screen at the same time. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So what kind of predictions can we perform using flops? So the first thing is that these figures have to be obtained from data sheets provided by manufacturers. So if I'm going to calculate the flops for an Intel processor, I need to go and look for the data sheet of that Intel processor. And basically it will tell me how many floating point instructions per cycle that that device can perform. And it will also tell me things like how many cores are in that processor. Similarly, if I look at the sheet for a GPU, I will be able to determine how many raster operations it can perform per cycle, as well as how many texture mapping units it contains. Okay, once I do this, I'm able to calculate what is known as a theoretical flop. So I have the speed typically also provided. I have the number of cores. Okay, and then the instructions per cycle. Similarly, you can get that in for GPU. Okay, or even in certain GPUs, they will provide you with cores and then threads and also instructions per cycle. Okay, so by doing that, it's easy to calculate. And simply sitting down, you can predict how a given computer is going to perform. For example, if I provide you the specifications of a single node in the AUST HPC cluster, you're able to calculate the theoretical flops for each node. And then you're also able to calculate the theoretical flops for the entire cluster once you can sum up the various nodes, the theoretical flops of the various nodes in the cluster. Generally, you will see that this calculation does not consider other things. It doesn't consider the speed or sizes of things like your cache. It doesn't consider the RAM, although in the case of the cache, you might say that, okay, if the manufacturer is providing a number, they may have taken account of the cache in there. It doesn't provide you any relationship with the speed of your RAM or the size of your RAM or even of your networking devices, whether you have a gigabit card or a 10 gigabit card. It doesn't matter, even though one is 10 times as fast as the other one. Okay. So in general, when you calculate the theoretical flops and you are going to use it for prediction, it's always wise to consider a range. A good range is from 75 to 90% of the value you get as being what is possible. Having said that, it's also important to note that some manufacturers will even go ahead and give you a value for the flops. So if you look at the Intel data sheets, typically they will also provide a value for what the theoretical flops for that processor will be. It's important to understand that in practice, you really can't achieve these theoretical flops. Okay. I think even with the best applications and the best setup, the values that the manufacturers give you are next to impossible to achieve. Okay. But that's why it's just a theoretical flop. It represents the upper maximum. An upper maximum that is never reached. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
So if I give you the specifications, just on paper, the specifications of the AUSD cluster, you can predict what the performance will be simply by calculating the theoretical flops. And then realistically, you can say, okay, we can probably achieve about 75% of that. So the expected performance will be between 75 to 90% of the theoretical flops that you have calculated. Okay, life is very easy so far. In practice, what happens is that there are now special applications known as benchmarks for trying to determine how well a processor is going to perform. And then since 1979, there's a Linpack benchmark. I think it was originally written in Fortran by a gentleman named Jack Dongara and his friends. I can't really remember, but I'm sure a few years ago we were also happy to have hosted Jack Dongara here at the ICTP. Anyhow, okay. The benchmark is designed to solve a dense matrix, more or less, an n by n system of linear equations. Okay. And when after it finishes running, it provides you a single reference number. So it was easy to compare. You simply take the benchmark, you compile it on your platform, you run it, and you get a number that tells you how well it's performing. And you can do the same for a different computer and get out that value. So the original one was written in Fortran, but I think they've also ported it to C. So there's a C version for it now. And then with the advent of parallel computers and supercomputers, it's also been ported for parallel systems. And so now the version that is used for measuring performance on supercomputers is called HPL, which is High Performance Linpack. Okay. There are limitations of Linpack, specifically the system of equations it solves is very heavily focused on engineering. So it's only practical in the engineering context. And an alternative algorithm has been developed, and that's the high performance conjugate gradient, HPCG. Okay, so that's an alternative benchmark to LINPACK. But the key limitation of these benchmarks are the fact that they are not representative of all practical applications. While you might say that it works well because it's an engineering application or a set of equations that represents something that could happen in engineering, it may not, it doesn't adequately represent what's happening in weather and climate modeling. Okay, nor does it represent what may be happening in the biological sciences. What do you think? What other applications can you think about? Or what other areas can you think about? So anyhow, anywhere where you have to employ other mathematical operations like second order differential equations and stuff like that are not easy to represent or are not gauged very well with LINPACK. So what does this mean? It means that you might run LINPACK on a system and you get a very nice figure, high performance. But when you bring in your real application, it performs poorly. And then the other thing is that benchmarks tend to be highly optimized. They tend to be highly coded by specialized programmers. Okay, and they are tuned. So even during when you are compiling a benchmark, it introduces some special optimizations based on the processor it feels you have in your system. Whereas your normal code is not going to be able to achieve that. So it doesn't really represent what happens in the practical sense. Needless to say, HPL and HPCG are used for ranking on the top500.org. So the major site that provides information about the top 500 supercomputers in the world uses HPL and HPCG. Are there any questions, comments?
No, sir, for now.
Okay. Okay, so since 2010, there's been an attempt to look at other benchmarks. So there was, I think, top500.org at one time introduced what they call the benchmark challenge. So they were trying to look for alternative benchmarks that will do much more than HPL. I forgot to mention that HPL just focuses on your CPU. So it doesn't focus on communication and stuff like that. HPL also is scalable, so it can work on multiprocessors. Okay, you can change parameters to tune it for multiprocessors. And typically for the top500.org, they will take the best value. So they run several times with different parameters on a given hardware and then take the best value for that. It doesn't do anything with respect to communication at all. So since 2010, there's been discussions pushed mainly by ACM and IEEE for a different metrics, the so-called traversed edges per second, TEPS. Okay, this attempts to measure both communication capabilities and computational power. And the basic idea is really around graph theory. And so it measures the ability of a machine as a cluster or a supercomputer as a single entity to communicate data between two points on a graph. The benchmark that they use is heavily based on algorithms for generating graphs and performing searches on this. What do you think is the key limitation even of this TEPS metrics? I mean, it has an obvious advantage over LIMPAC because LIMPAC focuses only on computational power. This one has also introduced something with respect to communications. What is the key limitation of this metric? Or what do you think is the key limitation of this metric? Is there anybody going to? Attempt. Okay, it's still more or less is not representative of all practical applications. So it's only representative of applications that we can solve using graph theory, but which is not really the case. So for many practical applications, it's not going to be able to tell us anything useful. But TEPS is the primary metrics used for ranking on graph500.org. Okay. Okay, so some other items. So assuming you are part of a team trying to either evaluate or design a HPC system, there are several things that most of these benchmarks do not consider right now. One is high-speed network. For example, if I run LIMPAC on a network where I have only gigabit connection versus running it on the same machines on a network where I have 10 gigabit connections, chances are that the performance are not going to be vastly different. Okay, so the high-speed network bandwidth as well as the latency. Latency is about moving data from one processor to the other are not really considered, but they are important factors, especially for certain types of applications. And then storage is also not, it's also quite important to pay attention to storage. Storage, there are two key metrics one may think about there. One is the capacity. So storage of 1 terabyte is way different from storage of 1 petabyte. Okay, there's a vast difference in their capacity. So a cluster that has 1 petabyte of storage, you will expect should be rated better than a cluster that has storage of 1 terabyte. And then not just that, the speed of the storage, the speed of I/O with respect to the storage is also important to characterize. Especially if you agree with me that a 1 petabyte slow storage should probably be rated lower than half a petabyte, but with extremely fast storage. So there are all kinds of metrics. There are benchmarks already for evaluating storage, and one of them is the there's a software for performing benchmark on storage. It does things like your sequential I/O, random I/O, and even parallel I/O, and then spits out numbers that you can use for plotting graphs or graphs in Excel or something that simple that will tell you the performance of one versus the other. For high-speed networks, there are benchmarks based on MPI. Okay, based on the MPI standard that we spoke about a couple of days ago. And you can actually use that for characterizing the high-speed network on a machine already. Of course, RAM, we're also looking at capacity. as well as clock speed. So there are various standards already. There's DDR3, DDR4, but they have various clock speeds. And typically, the faster you can clock a RAM, the better performance it is. Okay, so it's not just a question of size, but also how fast they can work. So putting slow RAM on a fast CPU, it's sometimes enough to kill performance. So whenever you are building high performance computing systems, you also need to pay attention to the capacity and the clock speed for RAM. Hardly mentioned is the cluster middleware. So things like which particular software is being used for managing or coordinating activities on the cluster. There are two key items here for consideration. One is scalability. So is my middleware able to handle 200 computers? Is it able to handle 1,000 computers? Is it able to handle 10,000 computers? Okay. And then when it does this, what is the latency? How long does it take us to start a job? How long does it take us to recover a node when a job has ended? So depending on this, we'll discover that the same technology that was used for the middleware in the AUST HPC cluster is not enough to handle a supercomputer. Okay, the idea is fundamentally similar, but a supercomputer may have something like 20,000 nodes, whereas on the HPC cluster of AUST, we have just 15 nodes. So in a sense, there's a vast difference between the middleware for them. And if I try to use that same software for 20,000 nodes, there's going to be a lot of issues because it's not able to scale up to that. So I will need to choose a different middleware layer. So scalability and latency, but job latency and things like how the turnaround time for my compute nodes. How long does it take the middleware to be able to make a node fully operational again after it has completed a particular task? Energy is beginning to get also a bit of mention, and I'm happy that you now have a green 500 list that is also available on the top500.org. But energy power consumption is quite important. Otherwise, we will have to build electrical energy generation plants just to power a single supercomputer. So once upon a time, it was felt that if you are going to invest in supercomputer technology, you will need to think of maybe building an electrical power dam, you know, just to supply the electricity that is going to be consumed by that supercomputer. It's also important to understand that there is always a cost. So the running cost. So it's not just saying, okay, I put the money down to build a HPC cluster. You also need to think about how much it will cost you to keep the system running on a day-to-day basis. And this is where power consumption comes in, because based on power consumption, you can make projections, even economic projections of how much it will cost you to build a cluster. I remember years ago when the AUST first approached me saying they would like to build a HPC cluster. My advice was, okay, whatever amount you have, can we split it into two? We're going to spend half on processors and then we'll spend the remaining on energy. Because that is the key strategy for ensuring a sustainable system. Unfortunately, that advice was not implemented. But if we had probably implemented it that way, we'll have a situation where the HPC cluster of AUST will have been available 24 hours a day. because it will have had some sustainable energy. We're actually thinking of either using solar or micro hydro solutions for powering it. And micro hydro was quite attractive and will have been easy to do based on the fact that AUST has a stream that runs within its land. So we could have done a micro hydro facility to keep the HPC system powered. It's not, it doesn't consume a lot. And I think with a very small investment at that time, we would have been able to obtain enough energy to keep the cluster running. The other thing to also look at with respect to energy is the efficiency. So how many flops am I getting for my watt, for a single watt? And that's used for power efficiency. You can also use this as matrices for comparing systems. And this is what is used for the Green 500 list that shows up, that you can also access via top500.org. So I have two questions here. How important do you think these items are? And which of the above do you think is more important and why? So three questions. How, which, and why? Anybody who's willing to provide some input?
All items are important. If I say like energy now, in terms of like power now, without power, the systems are not going to run. The power is important. Now, even if they, and also the middle cluster is not good, then the system won't actually perform very well. But with limited power and we have system is also good, and then system is scalable. Limited power, if it's so that the hardware subsystem and telemetry and latency are okay, without with little power, it can do more work. And then with more power, and then these other two are, you know, so we find that in order to attain like accuracy and, you know, faster time of execution, no power, hardware subsystem, and cluster middleware is faster than high power, low hardware subsystem, and low cluster middleware. That's what I think.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think, are there any other contributions?
I'm not far from what Efion said, but what I believe all of them are important in the way that if you are considering the purpose of having those particular clusters or HPC, if the purpose is maybe to produce to make a large computations in a fraction of a second, it means that we will consider much on the hardware. And also, if our main purpose or our main focus is to make it be available all the time, it means that we are talking about energy and also about the cluster middleware, whereby we are talking about scalability and latency. So all of them are important, depends on which criteria are we using to establish those HPCs.
Okay. So you don't have any, I think Ms. Efion sort of suggested she will go with energy, then hardware, subsystems, and then middleware. Do you have any sort of list of your own?
I don't have for now.
Okay, so you don't think energy is more important than the others?
Energy might be very important, but if, for instance, if we are using it to run only some few computations within a specified time, it means that we'll be needing the energy only for that time when we are using it. So it means that at that time, energy will be very important. But if we are using it all the time, it means that it's supposed to be working all the time. It means that also energy might be important. But it depends on the situation where we are actually using this HPC for.
Okay. Okay, I think if you remember, during our first week, we quickly established that HPC is a tool, okay, that can help you in many different fields. So whether we're looking at drug design, we're looking at aviation and logistics, we're looking at entertainment or even making movies, it's really a tool that can help you, okay? So it doesn't make a lot of sense to buy the best possible tool and then hang it on the shelf and don't use it. So it makes more sense to say, okay, I should buy a tool that I can use every day. The more I use it, the more I'm getting a return on my investment. So I think at the end of the day, even if you have a slow HPC, but you can use it when you want, it's equally just as good. But if you have a very fast HPC, but each time you put it on, you will have to sort of maybe declare a 21-day fast, because nobody is going to eat again because you have to pay the energy bill. Okay, it sort of defeats the whole purpose or the whole idea. Anyhow, the key concept is the following. Whatever system you have, it's a tool, and if you are going to get the best out of it, you have to continuously use it. You have to be able to continuously use it. The more you use the tool, the more you get out of it. If you don't use it, then you don't get anything out of it. I think in a country like Nigeria, we are very familiar with what has been called the White Elephant Project. So whenever you speak to government people and they're like, okay, let's do this, they think of the biggest, you know, the as big as it can be and stuff like that. But they don't really focus on what's going to happen afterwards, how much is it going to cost us to keep it running and stuff like that. So they just, it's not uncommon to find people buying the biggest Jeep available. I mean, there are certain Jeeps that I see that look like the engine of a trailer. And then you now think about, okay, how much gasoline? So if you think of a popular American car like the Hummer Jeep, if they tell you the gas consumption of, or the fuel consumption of that machine, you'll be like, it's impossible to run it, okay, or impossible to work with it. So the guy who has a small Toyota vehicle ends up being able to use his Toyota every day than the guy who has the Hummer. Because the guy who has the Hummer can't afford the fuel, he has to pack it and try and use public transport for the best part of the month and only drive the Hummer for one day in a month, you know? Okay, so I think it's also been suggested that many of these vary based on the application you are going to use. I think that's probably what we can summarize with respect to the hardware matrices. It's very important to understand which application you are going to deploy the cluster for. So if I'm building a cluster for doing climate modeling for predicting weather, benchmarks like LIMPACK in that respect are not very practical. Because LIMPACK might tell me, okay, you have this nice, super fast cluster, but at the end of the day, I need also high performance storage because I have to store data for maybe up to 150 years. And when I'm performing a calculation, I have to read this data and then perform various operations on them. Okay, and then there's a lot of inter-process communication happening even across computers. And so the high-speed network will also play a role there. And then, of course, my data is going to be heavily RAM-based. So having lots of RAMs and fast RAM is also going to be useful, which won't be captured by LIMPAC nor by the text. The cluster middleware, okay, just adds an overhead, but the overhead is more noticeable when you have more computers and you have more people trying to use a cluster. So on certain clusters, it's possible that users have to wait for maybe up to 24 hours before they can run their job. But if they had a smaller cluster available to them in their department, they could run their job maybe with a turnaround time of maybe 6 hours, but in smaller chunks. So they get more done rather than having to wait 24 hours for the big university cluster, okay? And then for departments or institutions or even companies that are going to make movies, at the end of the day, you have to pay an electricity bill. So for every hour you kept the cluster on to perform calculations or rendering for the movie, there's an equivalent cost that has to be factored in and then recovered at the end of the day. So bottom line is, if you have to determine specs or determine matrices for high performance for a cluster, especially if you are thinking of buying one or you are asked to advise about what should be bought, it's always important to understand the application that that cluster will be used for. And once you do that, it can help you tailor the components that are included for high performance. Are there any questions about this aspect?
So I have a question.
Okay.
So when you just said that when we have been asked to maybe make specifications for a cluster, I'm actually thinking that it means like getting the hardware, the computers, the nodes, then making the environment yourself, probably distributed environment, or that's what you mean, like specifying the kind of hardware, computers, GPUs and all that that will be used.
Yes, that's one way of looking at it. But the other way of looking at it is to say, okay, can I convince my bosses or convince management using numbers that the desktops they are planning to buy are not good enough to do the calculations we need? Or can I convince them using numbers that, okay, in addition to the desktops, we need to also get something for HPC? Or even to say, okay, as an organization, we want to buy a cluster. HP company is proposing this. Dell is proposing this. Lenovo is proposing this other one. What is the difference between all three of them? Apart from the sheer number of processors, how does it fit in? I mean, how do they compare against themselves? I don't know if you understand me.
Yes, sir. Okay, yes, sir, because I was actually thinking from the point that I would just like check the specification of the hardware, how fast it is and all that, if I'm going to make the HPC cluster myself.
Okay. Yes, but the truth is, like we have just suggested here, if I have very fast CPU, okay, the flops I'm measuring from the CPU is amazing, it's top of the world, but they are offering me slow RAM, Do you know that's an impact? Because at the end of the day, the same clock, okay, is going to drive both the RAM and the processor. And to make matters worse, whenever the processor wants data from the RAM, it will have to wait. Or when it wants to send data to RAM, it will have to wait. Okay, so having a fast is a bit like saying, I have a Ferrari car or a Formula One car, but my roads are simple dirt tracks, like you will find when you leave the expressway and going to somewhere like Lugbe or something like that. Okay, I don't know if you understand me.
Okay, I get now, sir. I get.
So having the fast car doesn't really mean anything if the roads are not good enough for you to run the car at full speed.
Okay, sir. So I have to put into consideration every other factor, not just looking at maybe...
Yeah, so if HP comes and says, we're offering you... let's say Intel processor at 4 gigahertz, and but you will only get 1 gigabyte of RAM at 2 gigahertz. That's already a problem. Yeah. And then they say, okay, because it's running at this high speed, we'll give you maybe 6 processors, or we'll give you 10 machines with these 4 gigahertz processors, and RAM is 1 gigabyte with 2 gigahertz of RAM. And then Dell comes and says, okay, we are going to offer you 10 machines with processors at 3.6 gigahertz and RAM at 3 gigahertz. Okay, and we give you 2 gigabytes of RAM at 3 gigahertz. Do you get me?
Yes, sir. I think I get the
calculating the flops will allow you to evaluate numerically what the relative differences are from these two vendors. And so you have a numerical way of making the choice or advising management, saying based on the calculations here, this system will be better than this. Unfortunately, many times...
Okay, sir. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Unfortunately, many times, many of these things in Nigeria tends to be, what is my cousin offering with respect to what somebody I don't know is offering? Okay? So it's a question of man knows man. So if the person I know is offering a very weak system, because I know him, he wins. Okay, whereas we should be looking at performance. More or less, this is what matrices allow us to do. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so we'll now move on to a different scenario. One of the key limitations we saw with the matrices like flops and TEPs were the fact that they do not tell the situation with respect to your own software. They tell the situation with respect to a set of algorithms and a set of situations that may not be useful for your own software or your own considerations. So what we're going to look at now is some other work that has come up over the years, but it's very good for looking at especially parallel versus sequential. So I have my own software and I want to be able to tell whether it will perform better if I write it in parallel or if I leave it as sequential code. And then what's the impact of saying I'm going to run it with 20 cores, or run it with 60 cores, or run it with 100 cores, or run it with 1,000 cores. Is it even practical? Will there be any improvement if I run it with 1,000 cores? Okay, these are questions that the benchmarks and the matrices we've considered earlier will not help you answer. So this part is focused on software, but more about what we find in our own software situation. So the first thing we'll do is to define certain objects, okay? And the first one is known as speed up. So typically the speed up when I'm using N processors is defined as the time for executing things sequentially divided by the time taken for executing the task on N processors. So in that sense, speed up measures what measures the gain I get from going from a sequential software or sequential approach to solving a task or a problem to parallel approach to solving that same task or problem. Typically, we expect that the speed ups should be obtained, the execution times should be obtained using the best possible algorithms. But it doesn't imply that they have to be the same algorithm. So the algorithm I use for sequential may not be the same algorithm I use for parallel, for the parallel implementation. But they are the ones that produce the best possible times in both cases. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I have a question. What if I calculate the speed up? So I have my software code, and after running it, I find that it took, 20 seconds to run. And then I put it on a parallel system. I'm trying to run it with a system that has 10 cores rather than one core. Okay. And after running it, it takes 50 seconds. Okay. What's my speed up in that situation?
So can you come and give me the question?
Okay. So we've looked at the equation for speed up. And we understood that it's nothing more than a ratio between the time I take to execute a task in sequential and the time I take to execute a task in parallel. Practically, let's say that I decide that I have this application, some application, and I want to run it, or I run it on my machine that has one processor, one core. And on a Pentium processor, and it ran for 20 seconds. Then I take the same application and I take it to a machine that has a Core 2 Duo, that's two cores, and it takes 50 seconds. So what's my speed up? It's very simple, 20 divided by 50, just the ratio between the time I took on one core sequential and the time I took for two cores. Yeah?
2/5.
Yes, 2/5, which is 0.4. That's 0.4, right? Yeah. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is the fact that you would have expected a value higher than one, yeah? But when you have values of speed up lower than one, it indicates that there is a problem. Either the wrong algorithm is being used or something similar. Okay. So the key thing is that we would like speed up to be greater than one, which shows that the sequential time is more than the time we took in parallel. That's quite nice. But once it's lower than one, it means the opposite is happening. We are taking more time in parallel than the time for sequential. So it may mean we need to change algorithm. It may mean there's some overhead, significant overhead we're not accounting for and stuff like that. Okay. So best speed ups tend to be greater than one. Another term is efficiency. Efficiency is nothing more than speed up divided by the number of processors. Okay, efficiency is always going to be between 0 and 1. An efficiency of 1 is quite good, but practically difficult to achieve. So if we look at the example we gave earlier, where our speed up was 0.4 and we had 2 processors on a dual core system, or 2 cores on a dual core system. So we have a situation where the efficiency is going to be 0.2, which is also quite low. So it is related to the speed up, but it just tells us fractionally how well the whole system is performing. So 0.2 is also quite low. Okay, so using these 2 figures, we can calculate, we simply run our application, measure the time for sequential, and then measure the time for parallel. And then we can calculate speed up and efficiency. Okay, so one practical way of saying, okay, I want to buy a large cluster with 100 computers and so, okay? You can say, okay, let me try and measure the impact of what I expect when I use my sequential code on this machine and when I do parallel on 5 or 10 of these computers. Sometimes if the amount of money you want to spend is large enough, you can actually find a vendor that is willing to arrange with another customer to give you access to their HPC cluster or platform, and you sort of run some trials and determine values for speed up and efficiency, okay, to also help you. And the difference is that these tend to be focused on your application and no longer the generic numbers provided by Linpack or the equipment manufacturer. Okay. And it's up to the vendor to try and give you access to a system that is as close as possible. Some of them will set up maybe a smaller demo system that you can also access and do some calculations on. I remember years ago when we had to do something like this, I think we had to visit several companies and at one point even try and run some calculations or run some applications to determine speed up and then efficiency as well. Okay, so there was a gentleman by the name of Quinn some time ago that said, okay, what if we try to, we've been looking at this thing as generally, but maybe we can say, what about does the size of my task have an issue? Or what's the impact of the size of my task on this? So he came up with this interesting mathematical equation. We are going to go into a bit of mathematics now. And that's, you can determine the time taken to run non-parallel version of a code. It changes with size, especially for things with matrices. So if I'm solving a matrix with 500 elements, it's going to be different from a matrix with 4 million elements, and which is probably different from another matrix that has 200 million elements or 2 billion elements, okay? So his idea was, if we can look at the time it takes to execute the non-parallel portion of my code, plus the time it takes to to look at the, I mean, the time I spend executing parallel portions of my code. And then I calculate an overhead, or I determine an overhead for parallelism. Okay, then I can make some calculations based on the idea that my sequential time is nothing more than the sum of the time taken to execute the non-parallel plus the time taken to execute the parallel portion. And then the time for parallel is given by that equation below, which factors in the overhead of parallelism. So the basic idea here is the following. Can I determine what kind of speed up I will have if I'm going to use OpenMP to parallelize with 10 threads or to parallelize with 60 threads? Okay, so the work of Quinn was really geared in that direction. So after I write my parallel code and I put OpenMP directives that allow some portions of the code, maybe when we come to loops, we split it into various threads and we execute the threads. I mean, we execute the loop, the for loop, we execute it in chunks in parallel. So he's saying that, yes, I've done that, but then I can still determine a sequential time. Okay, so now the only thing we're trying to vary is the size of our problem or the size of our parallelization. Okay, and then if I decide to use more threads, what is going to be the impact? Will I get a smaller time or will I get a bigger time? Showing that I'm just wasting my time with producing more threads. What are the limits? There are some, if you try to resolve all of that, you will get out a situation, I mean, the two key items we're interested in are the situation where there's no overhead. Overheads tend to be related to things like communication. I have to send data from one thread to the other. I have to wait for another thread and stuff like that. So where there's no overhead, we are talking about embarrassingly parallel. And so our time is just the portion we're executing sequential and the portion we're executing in practice. So that's, it's based on fitting stuff into the equations for speed up. Okay. And this embarrassingly parallel situation is nothing more than the upper boundary of speed up that we can calculate. Okay, are there any questions so far? This is all quite easy. Oops. Are we together?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, fine. Because I had a crash on one of the systems, but that's fine. Okay, so then in 1967, we had a gentleman by the name of Amdahl that decided to do some more mathematics on this. Okay, and he came up with what we know today as Amdahl's law. Okay, and that basically is shown mathematically below. And it's really saying for an application running on a single processor. And if you can determine the portion of that application that can run in parallel, then we can determine a maximum speed up simply by considering this based on the fraction that has to run in sequential. So for example, T is time taken to run on single processor. If I parallelize it, I can parallelize maybe 50% of the code, can do that in parallel. So another 50% can't be parallelized. So that fraction is always going to be there. Okay, and then I'm going to have the parallel version being lower, because it varies with the fraction of the code that we can do in parallel and the number of parallel processing or number of channels, so execution paths we are running in parallel. So all well and good, we end up with a very simple equation that relates everything no longer based on time, but based on fraction that can be parallelized and the number of processors that we can throw at the task. Okay, so interpreting Amdahl's law is really quite interesting because it suggests that as the number of processors increases, even if we are going to use an infinite number of processors, our maximum possible speed up is limited by the fraction of code we can run in parallel. Does that make sense? Let's think about it. So at this stage, assuming n is infinite, right? If n tends towards infinity, a simple division of alpha by infinity is zero. It's going to be so negligible that it no longer has an impact. So we then have 1/(1 - alpha). So which is this entity, because dividing alpha by infinity to add here makes out that fraction go away. And so it's not a very positive statement, because it says if 90%, I mean, practically now, it means if 90% of the code can be run in parallel, then the maximum possible speed up is always 10, regardless of the number of processors available or used. So even if I'm going to use 2 million processors on this task, I will never get a speed up that is better than 10. Do you agree?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so anyhow, the mathematics is there to prove it. And it's a very easy proof at the end of the day. It leads us to this graph, okay, which is Amdahl's law for speed up, okay? And essentially it says that depends on my value of alpha. If my value of alpha is 0.5, as which is half of my code can be executed in parallel, then I will see an increase going from 1 until about maybe let's say just after 10 processors, okay? And even if I continue increasing the number of processors after that, I don't really see a very big improvement in speed up. If it's 0.6, I have a slightly better graph, but it more or less follows the same thing. If it's 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, okay, that's looking quite good. We see that there's actually some vast difference even until after 60 processors. So even up to 64 processors, I will still get something similar even going on, but you'll notice that it's flattening out. It has started to flatten out and it will continue flattening out. So even if I'm going to use something like 1,000 processors, I may not see a good improvement with respect to 64 processors and 1,000 processors. Okay. Similarly, we can simply solve for efficiency and we get a curve that tells us virtually the same thing. So my efficiency reduces as we go on. So the more cores I throw in, the less efficient my system becomes. The point of cutoff depends on alpha. So essentially what this is just trying to tell us is that depending on what alpha is, alpha of course is the ratio of which part of my code can be executed using parallel, either OpenMP or stuff like that, or threads or MPI, versus the portion I have to do sequentially. So if that ratio is much higher than 0.9, as in over 90% of my code can be executed in parallel, then I have very good response by the system. So moving even up to 60 processors, I still get something quite okay. But the longer I go, the less I gain. So going from 64 cores to 128 cores may not give me that advantage I think I'm going to have. Going from 128 cores to 1024 cores may also not give me that advantage I expect to have. So Amdahl's law is typically very good for situations where we are trying to parallelize a sequential code. Okay. It doesn't consider the situation where the parallel code is completely different from the sequential code. That is where my algorithms are different. So Amdahl's law more or less predicts what's going to happen when I use OpenMP to parallelize my existing sequential code. It doesn't tell me what will happen when I rewrite my code from zero to use a different parallel algorithm. Okay, even when both are addressing the same problem. So can this law be used to predict the impact of using more cores for a task or even moving to a bigger HPC cluster? What do you think? Are there any takes on that? Yes, Ms. Ogbe. I didn't get it. Did you say yes or did you say no?
I don't think so.
Okay, so you are more for the no. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, Hawa writes that she will say yes. In this respect, it's really yes. Okay, it's simply saying that if I take exactly the same code and I'm running it with 20 cores currently, because that's what I have access to, then I take it to a bigger cluster where I have 300 cores. What's the impact? Okay, so Amdahl's law will tell us whether there will be an impact or not. And according to Amdahl's law, that's related to the ratio of my code that can be parallelized and the fraction that cannot be parallelized that has to be run sequentially. So it can tell me exactly how many cores, where the limitation is for any code, how many cores are important for running a code. And also, if I increase the number of cores, will there be an impact? Or if I move to a bigger cluster, will my runtime change or will it not change? Okay, so that's two key items that the Amdahl's law can be used to address. Of course, the situation, if you look at the graph, it's not very encouraging. At the end of the day. So there is a different law that was also came into being in 1988 by two gentlemen, Gustafsson and Bassis, but it's usually called the Gustafsson's Law. Okay. And it says that if we consider the total time it takes for a parallel application to run on n processors, and alpha is the fraction of that application that runs in parallel, then we can arrive at a situation where our speed up, okay, or the maximum speed up will be determined by this simple equation, 1 minus alpha plus alpha times n. Okay, this is also sometimes called the scaled speed up. Okay, and you can see the derivation here. It's just a very simple fact. So we make an assumption based on the sequential time. I'm saying that there's a relationship between the time for sequential and the time we spend in parallel. Okay, and so what it's saying is that as the number of processors increase, the maximum possible speed up in performing a given task in parallel is limited by alpha times n, where alpha is how much I can parallelize that code. So essentially it says if 90% of my code can run in parallel, then the maximum possible scaled speed up is always going to be 0.9 times n. Do you agree?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So trying to plot the Gustafsson's law for different values of alpha gives us a completely different graph completely. And you notice that this one appears to be much more linear. And this is the kind of graphs we like because it says, okay, if I get more processors, I'll do better. Is that what it's saying? Is that what it's suggesting? Okay, so if I get more processors, I'll do better. If I have 20 cores, my speed up is one value. If I have 60 cores, my speed up is a completely different value. If I have 64 cores, I get other values of speed up. If I have 32 cores, get better speed up. Okay, and alpha seems to just change the slope of the speed up I will experience, how much speed up I will get, or the rate at which I will change. Okay, similarly, when I look at the efficiency predictions based on Gustafsson's law, I get decent efficiencies. Okay, not the low efficiencies we're seeing with respect to Amdahl's law. Amdahl's law gave a dead situation with respect to efficiency. Efficiency drops and goes very low. Whereas Gustafsson's law says, okay, there will be some drop, but it's not going to be that bad. And eventually it's going to stay steady. And we kind of like this. So if we have 90% of our code that can be running parallel, then we have a situation where the efficiency remains okay. It may drop as soon as we start increasing the number of cores, but it's going to remain quite high. Okay.
From this graph, efficiency and the number of processor, can you tell if there's a pattern, like if you're increasing the number of if you're having a higher number of efficiency, can you say, okay, the number of processors are also higher? Like, is it directly proportional? Are they increasing at the same time or they are decreasing at the same time?
Okay. As you can see, how do I put it? There's a linear relationship between efficiency and number of processors, but the impact is not that high. Okay, so essentially we can see that the equation is nothing more than one minus a delta. So it's just a very linear equation. So, and then at the end of the day, that delta sort of flattens out. So the change, the loss in efficiency is not that high, even if as I increase the number of processors. I repeat, the difference between this and the Amdahl's law is the fact that this considers things from the parallel perspective. So if I can parallelize my algorithm, okay, if I can, if I've split stuff into tasks, within that task, if I'm going to do threads, if I can do more threads inside a particular task, then I'm going to have a constant efficiency. Okay, I don't lose efficiency. I don't fall down like we saw with Amdahl. Okay, but I continue staying quite high. But the rate at which my efficiency is going to change is not going to be, or the rate at which my efficiency drops is going to tip out and approaches zero as we go on. Okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay, so we can in principle do some refinements on the work, okay, that has been done by Quinn, Amdahl, and Gustafsson. Okay, so we can define our parallel execution time to be the time spent in computation, the time spent in overheads, and the time spent in message transfer. Okay, so this even will allow us to sort of make some calculations when you are using shared memory and when you are using MPI. So if we want to calculate the differences between using the approach of OpenMP or the approach of using MPI, this consideration allows us to perform that. Okay, and so we can actually determine, so for example, if I'm using OpenMP, I have lower overheads for T0H and sort of lower overheads for also message transfer. If I'm using MPI, I will have higher overheads for TOH as well as some higher overheads for TM, which is message transfer. So fitting all of this into any of the previous equations or the initial equations we saw for Quinn, okay, we can arrive at a situation where we determine maximum values for what we are going to experience for any application, but also taking into account whether we are doing message passing or whether we're using shared memory. I don't know if you understand me. Okay, it might be difficult to understand, but the key concept is that we can also extend this work that these gentlemen have done. It's, at the end of the day, it's really just a set of mathematics to try and determine what are the upper limits or why we are seeing certain behaviors. So for example, if I parallelize my code using OpenMP, which is a shared memory paradigm, or I parallelize my code using pthreads, what's the difference? Okay. This consideration allows us to fit, to obtain numbers that we're going to fit into, or even to simulate numbers and fit them into the previous equations and then get out some upper boundaries. For example, whereas Amdes law talks about the fraction of the code that runs sequentially. Gustav's law talks about this fraction of the code that runs in parallel. Quinn was more or less focused on time and the size of the problem. Okay, size of problem and number of processors. Okay, so if I can determine what fraction of my time is used on overhead for pthreads and what fraction of the time is used for overhead in message transfer, I can figure out the efficiency and the speed up, more realistic values of efficiency and speed up, and even identify differences between different implementations of software libraries like pthreads versus OpenMP versus MPI, which were the three paradigms we looked at when we're considering. Okay. So now let's consider a very simple exercise. Assuming we have a sequential program. Assuming we have a sequential program, okay, that takes 14 seconds for I/O and 500 seconds for computation. And we assume that only computation can be parallelized. So that's an assumption, which means that sequential is going to be 14 seconds is always going to be needed for the sequential part. Okay, and 500 seconds for computation. So what's my T sequential? T sequential, it's 514. Okay, what is alpha if we're considering Hamdel's law? Yeah. So let's look at it. Amdes law says so alpha is going to be what? Anybody?
500 seconds.
Are you sure? Why do you say 500 seconds? Remember, alpha is a fraction. Right.
Is it 500 divided by 514? So is that what the fraction means?
Okay. The truth is that we can't really determine alpha from this because alpha is more concerned with the code, not the time taken. Okay, so we are not given here any information about the time it takes to execute things in parallel. Are we? We are only told that we require 14 seconds and then 500 seconds for computation. So the total time, T sequential, is 514. So alpha cannot be determined purely from dividing the numbers, okay? But we can, in principle, say, okay, T sequential is going to be 514, right? T parallel is 1 minus alpha times 514 plus alpha times 514 divided by n, where n is the number of processors. Does that make sense? Hello? If you look at the question, the only thing we are given is just the sequential time. We are not even given the parallel time.
Okay, sir.
Okay. So we are given sequential program. So we know that it's sequential. It uses 14 seconds for IO and 500 for computation. We assume only computation can be parallelized. What is the maximum possible speed up from using X processors? So looking at this equation, speed up can be given by sequential divided by T parallel. We are not given T parallel, but we are given T sequential, 514. So we know that T parallel is related to T sequential by this expression, which is based on the number of processors that we have and the factor alpha, but it's still related to the sequential time. So by simply saying, okay, we can resolve that calculation, 514, blah, 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 blah. We're not going to see anything more than or anything vastly different from one of the Amdahl curves. Okay. Is there any way we can make any assumption in this case with respect to what alpha should be? Is there any possible hope for assuming what alpha should be?
Well, so how about the part that said that assuming 500 and the computation can be parallelized?
Yeah, I mean, does that really tell us anything? Can we use that to determine alpha? Is it possible? Is it possible to use that to determine alpha? The challenge is that we have an unknown quantity n. So if we are looking at this equation, okay, we have the time sequentially. We have the sequential time, but we don't have the parallel time. But it's given by this expression, but that's related to n. but we know T. Okay, but we are still missing alpha and N. So we can simply vary the value of N and solve for alpha. Does that make sense? That's one possibility. Will that give us anything useful? Okay. Okay. So let's look at the second one. Calculate the scale speed up for a parallel program that requires 200 seconds to run, of which 15 seconds was used for sequential processing. Unlike the first question, we are given two values. Okay, we know that T parallel is 200, and in that, out of that 200, 15 seconds was used for parallel processing. Was used for sequential processing. And so we are being asked to calculate the scale speed up. So we simply use this, which is the equation for scale speed up. So we know the total time here. And we know the fraction of it that is used for sequential processing. So what's the fraction of the code that was a fraction of the application that runs in parallel?
So please, can you go back to the question?
Okay, so calculate scale speed up. Scale speed up, we have to assume we are going to apply Gustafson's law because of the name scale speed up. If we're asking just for speed up, then we can, in principle, look at Amdahl. Okay. So the challenge in both of these is that they don't give us N. Okay, so ideally it would have been nice if we're given a value of N, then we can calculate a value of alpha. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And so how do you solve this, or how do you arrive at a value in these two situations? So in order to solve either of them, we have to assume a value for N. So in the first case, we are told explicitly that we should use X processors. But we can set X to be a value. Let X be 2. Okay. And then you make your calculations. You can determine what alpha is. Okay. And the graph will follow the graph of alpha. You can also determine, if you make an assumption of 3, okay. Does that make sense? So for varying values of N, what would you get? by the time you solve in the first case, Amdahl's law, the second case, Gustavsson's law, you'll find that as you vary n, you will end up with a value. Okay, and that value should be your maximum. Are we together?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the key thing is we're provided with two values, numerical, 14 seconds, 500. We can calculate a sequential time. Here we are given a parallel time and 15 seconds. In order to address any of this, we are not given alpha and we're not given n. Okay, but we can assume a value for n and simply vary n. And based on that, we can figure out a value for alpha. You will discover that according to both laws, once we have a constant alpha, we can determine where things will be. Okay, so here we have maximum speed up, maximum speed up, maximum speed up, or optimal speed up. And then here we have the speed up also tapering out. So for this one, it's clear that as we continue to increase n, the value of speed up is going to remain constant. Okay. So by varying n, we can determine what alpha will be. Okay, based on the numbers we have here. So based on the numbers, I can build a table where I simply for x is equal to 2, for x is equal to 1, what do I get? For x is equal to 2, what do I get? For x is equal to 3. Okay, I build a table that I can use to plot and then determine things from there. Similarly for the second one, but here I'm giving the parallel time. Okay, and then 15 seconds is for sequential execution. I'll try to vary n and see what I get. Okay, in conclusion, we've looked at a couple of hardware matrices, which were the floating point operations per second, flops, and the traversed edge per second, or traversed edges per second. Both of them are available as benchmarks that can be compiled and run on almost every platform you have access to. TEPS is, let's say, developed with machines like supercomputers in mind. Okay, whereas flops can go from anything from a single computer to a cluster to a supercomputer. There are versions of it available. They have their limitations, but they allow us to tell effectively things that, or how, I mean, to determine relative performances. Of course, because they are relative, the real situation may differ based on the application we are looking at. For code that you write, or for code that you have access to the source code, speed up and efficiency are two important factors for measuring the performance, especially when you are thinking of parallelizing. Amdahl's law is useful for predicting speed up from looking at the sequential aspects of the code, while Gustavsson's law is focused on predicting speed up from working in parallel. Okay, that's the end of our lessons for today, or end of our slides. I don't know, are there any questions or anything you want me to cover again? Okay, if not, I think we can go into trying to talk about the modalities for the exams. I got a note from the class rep yesterday saying that the class would not like to have an exam. Is this the consensus of the class?
Yes, sir.
Come again. Okay, I said I got a note from your class rep saying that because of the electricity situation and also network, they'll prefer to do just have everything graded on assignments instead of having an exam, especially as somebody has to write the exam using the phone. Okay, I think I gave it some thought. I also asked that this request should also be forwarded to the head of department. At the end of the day, I gave it some thoughts, and I think it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to say there's not going to be an exam. Okay, there has to be an exam. There are challenging situations, but the key thing is there are also ways you can address these situations. There are ways you can get around them. Okay. For example, if we say we are going to have a 90-minute exam, it means for that 90-minute period, it's up to you to figure out what you are going to do with respect to electricity situation and even network connectivity. It doesn't mean you have to be online for the whole 90-minute period. Okay. But it just means that at the beginning of the 90-minute period, I will issue you the questions. And then at the end of the 90-minute period, I will close accepting submissions. Or I'll close accepting answers. Now, for the people who are going to work on cell phones, it's very easy that some of the questions you may have to answer on a blank sheet of paper using your normal biro. Okay, and then once you've finished answering, you have to send me a picture, an image of your answer sheet. So there are various ways of getting around this. And I think not having an exam has an impact on the overall quality of what you learned in any academic program. Exams may not be the best, but they are still the best way we have available for gauging individual performance and relative performances. Okay, so that's my official response. We have to have an exam. The only thing to identify now is what day you would like to have the exams. The options are tomorrow, Saturday, or Sunday. Okay.
Okay, sir.
Sir, our biggest fear is about the network, most especially. Okay, what if after, at the end of the 90 minutes, the network is now fluctuating because we can't really say when or how the network is going to behave that very day. That's our major concern.
Okay. Okay, so there are several things that can happen. One is you submit before the time is up, in which case you are okay. So one is to make sure you are not submitting last minute. Typically, anything that you take into the last minute is a disaster. Okay, so even if I say 90 minutes, it means you have to plan to work for like 45 minutes. Sorry, like for 75 minutes. And then the last 15 minutes, you focus on making sure you submit your work. Now, failing that, for example, for the person who's going to take a snapshot of your work that you worked on paper. I mean, everybody can do it. I'm going to recommend that you use this application. There's an application on the Android platform called the Microsoft Office Lens. Okay, I'll put it on the chat. Microsoft Office Lens. Essentially, that's without a final E. Essentially, what it does is that it converts your phone into a scanner. So you can, as long as your phone has a camera, or you can have access to a phone with a camera, you can actually take a snapshot of your answer sheet. The key thing is that I can expect a grace period of 15 minutes, but as long as the timestamp on the photograph by this application is lower than the time of the end of the exam. Do you get me?
Yes, sir.
So it means that you have to take this photograph of your answer sheet that you are going to send to me before the time is up. Even if you spend 5 minutes uploading it and stuff like that, once I look at the timestamp of the photograph and see that it's lower than the time you took the picture, then I will accept it. But if it's, you send me a picture and the timestamp on that picture is beyond the time for the exam, of course I cannot accept it, because it meant you didn't honor the terms of our agreement. Okay. These are the same conditions that are being applied in universities in developing countries. So even in the UK, students who had to write exams last month more or less had to do this. Some parents had to send dongles to their poor kids who didn't have internet at home. Okay, so they can actually participate in this exam. So the onus is on you to sort of make sure you have data on your phone. Okay, and you can also arrange for a sibling to be on standby in case your own phone is acting up, that you can just use that person's phone and catch the photographs and email them to me. Okay.
Sorry, sir. The snap which we're supposed to use this application, because for me I don't have a smartphone, so using somebody's phone and install the program to their phone is a bit but don't work.
So, I mean, what I will prefer is to have scanned images. So if you are going to find a scanner and scan your handwritten work and send me the photograph, I think that will be fine. But the key thing is that the timestamp on the scanned image have to be equal to. And of course, there's only a 15-minute window after the end of our time before I will stop accepting submissions. Okay. So let's put it this way. If we say the exam is 75 minutes, then you have 15 official minutes to submit your work and 15 minutes of grace period to submit again. Okay.
Okay, sir. Okay, sir.
Unless you can demonstrate from MTN
please, that,
or from your network that there's absolutely no network in your area. Yeah.
And okay, sir. May we ask you about the coverage? Because you know you taught us a lot, so I don't know how the exam will cover.
Is it possible to prepare for everything? I mean, we didn't really do a lot. I think the class I taught a few years ago, we did a lot more than, I mean, I had those guys even writing MPI code. They wrote MPI code. They wrote OpenMP code. They wrote pthreads code. They ran it on the cluster, executed it, or executed it on the desktops in the lab, in the case of pthreads and OpenMP. They were able to do that in the lab. We tried different things, even things like matrix multiplications, vector additions, dot products. We did a lot of. So we've kind of taken it easy this time due to COVID. It's not been a lot of work. At the end of the day, we just have seven presentations. Okay.
Okay, sir.
But think of it this way. I'm not going to ask you things like things you will find on slide ABC or slide number of so-and-so date. No? The questions have to be practical. Essentially, what I'm assuming is that it's up to you to set the exam conditions yourself. That is, if you feel you have to go and look for some solution on Google, I mean, it's up to you. It's not like I require you to be online and sitting in front of your camera during the exam period. Okay.
Okay, sir.
So while I understand that there may not be enough time for you to do what we did with the previous homework, which is you log into the cluster and do things practically, I may ask you to provide a job script, but you can just write it out, or provide a C code, you can just write it out. So, yeah. But it has to be in your own handwriting.
Okay, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Has everyone submitted his second homework? Okay, so class rep, I guess you guys.
I hope more.
Come again.
I was saying, I hope everyone has submitted the assignment.
Okay, I was going to say that the class rep, the onus is on you guys now to decide on a date and time, and then we'll take it from there. Would that be possible? It's not possible for we to have different times for everybody. We just have to all use the same time slot. I would prefer if we all use the same time slot. Sunday, what time?
Two p.m. Or 3 p.m.
3 p.m. Okay. The thing is, I have a meeting on Sunday at that will be 4 p.m. Nigerian time. So it will be nice if I can get everything sorted out before 4 p.m. But if you guys say 2 p.m. or if you say 3 p.m., is everybody saying 3 p.m.? I can probably, it's probably okay. I can do 3 p.m. too.
Thank you. Thank
you,
sir.
Is it 3 p.m.?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay, 3 p.m. Sunday. The date of Sunday is 28. 3 p.m. on Sunday, the 28th. Okay. So, do you want us to have a revision session tomorrow? If you guys have questions. Only if you guys have questions.
Okay, sir, if we have some rest of class and questions.
Okay. In principle, I can also open the room tomorrow if there's anybody that wants to drop in. And ask questions or something like that. You can feel free to drop in and drop out. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, sir.
Okay. Okay.
Good, sir. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon. Okay. Okay, bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, bye, sir.
And in case we don't see again, all the best for the exams.
Yes, sir.
We'll probably see for the exam day, or we'll probably hear on the exam day. Okay.
Okay, sir.
Okay,
bye. Okay, sir. Okay, bye.